Hey, everybody. It is Tuesday, March 26th. You're listening to the Mo News Podcast. I'm Moshe Wanunu.
Hi, Moshe. I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts.
And we read all the news and read between the lines so you don't have to. Jill, I was just checking on our brackets in the March Madness tournament we're having over in Mo News Premium. I currently rank in 216th place. Have you checked on your bracket?
Okay, so maybe I shouldn't have suggested that we do this topic. I didn't get my bracketing in time. So I'm just going to piggyback on yours. I didn't get to do a bracket. I'm sorry.
651 Mo News Premium members enter the bracket, and you couldn't take the time to fill out your bracket.
I tried, but when I got there, I was like 2 minutes too late. The truth is, Moshe, I'm sad because my teams are not in the tournament this year. So Michigan, yeah, not even close. Ohio State was on the cusp where my husband went, and I root for them very much so, especially in basketball. And they didn't make it. So it took me a few days to kind of like get
sad.
The energy to want to do
sad.
It.
I was sad. And then you didn't want to have to make those choices. I get it. For those of you unfamiliar, if you're a Mo News Premium member, we're doing a tournament challenge this year. We have an ESPN bracket thing going on. And right now, out of the first two rounds, Jill, there is a 5-way tie for first place. I posted them on the Mo News Premium Insta. We'll see how they do going into the Sweet 16. But we have prizes for first place, second place, and third place, including Mo merch, free year Mo News Premium. So enjoying that. Jill, after the first round, the first day, the person leading the tournament was a 4-year-old named Teddy. His mom is a Mo News Premium member. And she's like, I let my son choose. And after the first day, he was in first place. She's like, he made some crazy choices. He picked based on the letter T, the letter C, what color the teams were, and said that if you were a lower seed and you beat a higher seed, that gave you magic powers. And that worked, apparently, for a day. Teddy is now down near me in the picks. Jill, I didn't have such rationale. I went more with like gut and history. As I saw recently, Larry David was asked about this in an interview, in a sports interview. And they're like, hey, do you fill out a bracket, Larry? And he's like, how can I follow all these teams? Like, how can I know like who's good on Drake and like who's playing for Duquesne right now? Like, I don't. So I've stopped filling them out. So I think a lot of us just gut checked it. But it's been fun to keep folks up to date on something that isn't like, you know, depressing news every day.
It's a wonderful distraction. But speaking of news, we got to get to some. Now to the headlines. For the first time since the October 7th attack on Israel, the UN Security Council passes a call for a Gaza ceasefire. The diplomatic fallout after the U.S. did not veto the resolution. A tale of two Trump cases, a legal win and loss for the former president. And he could soon be in for a windfall of cash as the social media platform Truth Social set to go public at the NASDAQ today. Meanwhile, Boeing CEO stepping down in the wake of ongoing safety problems, and the FAA is cracking down on United Airlines after some safety scares involving its planes. Preview of today's Supreme Court hearing on the abortion pill mifepristone. Federal agents raid Sean Diddy Combs' homes in Los Angeles and Miami. And Florida taking action to keep kids safe online, banning social media accounts for kids under the age of 14. And it only took a century and then some, but the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona will be completed in 2026. Plus, Moshe is on this day in history. Let's start with the Middle East. The United Nations Security Council on Monday passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza during the month of Ramadan and called for the unconditional release of all the hostages. Ramadan lasts for about 2 more weeks. This is the first resolution demanding a ceasefire to pass at the council after 4 previous failures. The resolution passed with 14 votes in favor. The United States abstained from voting, but did not veto it, like with similar previous resolutions, thus allowing it to pass. The resolution stresses that all parties must comply with their obligations under international law. It deplores all attacks against civilians and all acts of terrorism and notes that it is illegal to take hostages under international law. It does not specifically condemn Hamas, which was the language that the U.S. previously proposed, but it had been opposed by Russia and China. Moshe, the most common question that we're getting is this binding? What does this actually mean? And the answer is it is mostly symbolic.
Yes, as most things at the UN are pretty symbolic, the UN doesn't have an enforcement mechanism, though the Security Council technically sort of kind of does, but it's through the member countries. Now, until now, the US has been vetoing these resolutions for the most part, anyone that mentions a ceasefire. As of last week, the language the US wanted was that they also wanted the resolution to include a specific mention of Hamas, a condemnation of Hamas. Now, China and Russia both pushed back on that. So they came up with this resolution, and this is sort of a signifier here that the U.S. has sort of had it with the Israeli government in allowing this through, the U.S. saying this is not a policy change. We didn't vote yes on it. We just allowed it to go through. But in reality here, don't expect much from this. The Israelis will continue to do their thing. Hamas not known to abide by ceasefires either. They've refused to put down their arms. No sign they'll release the Israeli hostages without hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, including a bunch of Hamas fighters, released in exchange for that. So while Security Council resolutions are considered technically international law here, the council can't enforce it. And it doesn't look like anybody else will. The Israelis criticized the U.S. for allowing this resolution to pass. Netanyahu, the prime minister there, saying it's a retreat from the consistent American position since the beginning of the war. The U.S. pushed back, saying, Netanyahu, why are you making a big thing out of this? The resolution also mentions the hostages should come home. The Israelis, again, wanted condemnation and a specific mention that Hamas started this war, and they wanted a linkage, meaning no ceasefire until the Israeli hostages are home or some are coming home. There was no linkage here. It was more of a, we would like this in the resolution, a ceasefire, but we would also like hostages to come home, like many UN resolutions are, Jill. It's a lot of aspiration and request, no declaration. But still, it's a sign of the division here between the Israeli government and the U.S. government right now.
Yeah, and there's already been some diplomatic fallout. Netanyahu said he's no longer going to be sending a high-level delegation to the United States for talks about a planned military operation in that southern Gaza city of Rafah. President Biden was the one who had asked for the meeting. The Biden administration has expressed their concern about a military incursion into Rafah, where there are currently about 1.5 million Palestinians right now, who many of whom fled from different parts of Gaza. A spokesperson for the United States defended the decision to not veto the resolution. As you were mentioning, they say it's consistent with their long-term position. Most importantly, that there should be a ceasefire and that there should be a release of hostages, which is what we understood also to be the government of Israel's position. But the obvious takeaway here, as you were mentioning, is that the United States not happy with Israel's military situation right now.
Yeah, though it is notable, the Israeli defense minister already on the ground in Washington. So he's having a whole bunch of senior level meetings right now with U.S. representatives. There's still a lot of communication happening at a number of levels, despite the theater here on the surface yesterday. And a lot of this for domestic political consumption, it benefits Biden right now among progressives and among critics in the Democratic Party to show that he's challenging the Israelis. And over in Israel, it benefits Netanyahu to show that he's pushing back on America and the world and not letting them tell Israel what to do. So in both cases, the domestic politics here appears to be overwhelming the policy, even though behind the scenes, there's a lot of communication still happening. Jill, it does come as former President Trump did an interview in the last day with an Israeli media outlet called Israel Hayom. It's actually a newspaper that was started by the casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, a huge Republican donor. And in that interview, Trump says, listen, Israel, I would have done exactly what you did after October 7th. I'm your biggest supporter. He then goes on to blame Biden for October 7th and saying that Biden is weak on Israel. But then notably, Trump does say in the interview, you guys got to wrap up the war. You got to finish up the war here because you are losing support abroad. So you even hear that from Trump, who is over the top in terms of his support for Israel, but says in an interview, it's time to wrap things up.
Speaking of Trump, a tale of two Trump cases, some big updates on Monday on two of his legal battles. So the good news for the former president, a New York appeals court lowered the amount that he must pay as a bond, pushing back the seizure of some of his property. So the judge ruled that he must pay a $175 million bond as he appeals a massive civil judgment for fraud, falsifying business records, falsifying financial statements, and insurance fraud. Trump had previously faced a deadline yesterday to pay about three times that amount, a $454 million bond payment. And he was having a lot of trouble coming up with that amount. His lawyers had requested more time. So now he has less money to come up with and more time to do it. The judge also gave him an extra 10 days to hold off New York Attorney General Letitia James from collecting that massive penalty. Without the money, the state would have been allowed to just start seizing Trump's properties. He said he will abide by the appeals decision and post the $170 million bond. And if he does post it by the new deadline, he'll be able to continue to appeal the judgment in court without having property seized. And it comes as Trump's net worth is about to go up significantly today. The company behind his social media app, Truth Social, is expected to start trading on the NASDAQ, potentially delivering a windfall of more than $3 billion to the former president. Trump Media will trade under the stock symbol DJT.
His initials.
Donald J. Trump. The former president would own about 58% of the company. It just merged with a shell company. But he might not be able to sell his shares for another 6 months, as is typical with these types of deals.
Yeah, they'd have to change a provision for him to be able to sell his shares. But then, of course, the company could collapse. He owns 79 million of the 135 million shares, so a vast majority there. And if he's selling his shares, you can imagine other people would. So it's not clear how this transpires and how he'll be able to hold up this valuation, Jill. There's a lot of questions here about this $5 or $6 billion valuation and where this will go on the open market. Because right now, research shows that they only have about 5 million active users on Truth Social. They haven't officially disclosed that, but that's what research shows. Compare that to some other social media accounts. TikTok has 2 billion. Facebook has 3 billion. Instagram has more than 2 billion. Even Twitter X has hundreds of millions of users. Again, Truth Social estimated to have 5 million. And then there's the revenue numbers. Last year, Trump Media lost $49 million in the first 9 months of the year. It brought in just about $3 million in revenue and had to pay out almost $40 million in interest expenses. So a lot of questions here about the shell company, the propped up share price here, how they're taking this public and what this means. So that's certainly something we'll be watching today and in the coming days on the market. In the meantime, as you mentioned, he also got some negative legal news yesterday. And the first of the four criminal trials, we now have an official date, April 15th, of when that'll start. That is the hush money trial into the payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels and how he repaid one of his attorneys. This is one of the four criminal trials he was set to face this year. Probably the only one that'll happen this year. The rest right now appear to be postponed. He tried to postpone this one further yesterday. Judge saying, nope, I'm setting a date. This will begin in mid-April. And we'll have to see what happens with this. This is considered the weakest of the four criminal cases against Trump. This has to do with reimbursements back in 2015, 2016, where they tried to pay off Stormy Daniels to not go public with her accusations of an affair with Trump in that first campaign against Hillary Clinton. He then found a way to repay his attorney for it in a way that he's accused of doing illegally. This case lingered for a long time. Other folks didn't want to pursue it. Then Alvin Bragg, the DA in New York, comes in and says, I'm going to give it a shot. And so we'll see what comes of this case and the potential impact, if at all, it'll have on Trump when it comes to politics.
So far, at least in this specific case, Republicans have come to his defense. Trump even signaled that he thinks this could potentially work in his favor because he says people would see that he is being treated unfairly. And this seems to be, of all of the criminal cases, the one with the least amount of bite, I guess is the way you could describe it. It's the one most people think he's being unfairly targeted.
Right, because the other cases have to do with election interference, him trying to change the vote, January 6th, taking home hundreds of national security documents, classified documents. And so there you can see more of an impact. But again, all those cases delayed right now for a variety of reasons, including the tactics Trump attorneys are taking, but also incompetence on the part of the prosecution, especially in that Georgia case where we've been telling you about Fani Willis and all of the mess down there.
Lots of news coming up, but we want to quickly thank some of our partners here, starting with a new partnership with Good Chop. Good Chop offers fully customizable boxes of high quality meat and seafood delivered to your door on your schedule. Everything is vacuum sealed and frozen at peak freshness, so you could stock your freezer and cook when you want. Choose from over 70 high quality cuts, 100% grass-fed ribeyes, USDA prime filet mignon. They also offer sustainable and wild-caught seafood like salmon, Pacific cod, scallops, shrimp, and more. Hungry yet? We cooked the salmon a couple of weeks ago, and just yesterday we made some meatballs, and they were delicious and a hit with both of my kids. Unlike many other companies, Good Chop sources its meat and seafood exclusively from American farms and fisheries, so you can support local family farms and independent ranchers right here in the United States. And it won't cost you a fortune. Good Chop's price per meal starts at just $3.74. Good Chop especially prides itself on sourcing meat that comes with no antibiotics or added hormones ever, no artificial ingredients, only the good stuff. And they are so confident in the quality of their cuts that they offer a 100% money back guarantee. So love Good Chop or you get your money back. Go to goodchop.com/monews120 and use the code monews120 to get $120 off your first four boxes. That's code at monews120 at goodchop.com/monews120 for $120 off.
And one longtime sponsor that we tell you about often on this podcast is AG1. Whether it's the Instagram account, the newsletter, or here on the podcast, we tell you about health trends, food trends, the importance of getting all your nutrients. And that's why I gave AG1 a try more than a year ago now. As I was trying to take my various vitamins throughout the day, I'd visited a nutritionist, and it was hard to get them all in. And what I loved about AG1 is it's just one scoop with a glass of water in the morning, and you get on with your day knowing that you've gotten more than 75 important ingredients, tons of vitamins and minerals, pre and probiotics to support digestion and gut health. It's your nutritional insurance policy, as we told you on this podcast. With your first purchase of AG1, Athletic Greens is giving Mo News listeners a free one-year supply of their vitamin D and five free travel packs of AG1. That deal is all yours if you visit drinkag1.com/monews. Again, that is drinkag1, as in drink, A-G, the number one, .com/monews, where you can get a discounted monthly subscription or try it just one time for just 1 month. Again, drinkag1.com/monews for this special deal.
Time now for the speed read. Something to watch today at the Supreme Court from CBS News. Arguments over access to mifepristone, a pill used to end early pregnancies, are set for today. It is a high-stakes case that could impact women in all 50 states, even in those which have not banned abortion since the court overturned Roe v. Wade back in 2022. The justices will focus on a decision from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. It found that the FDA made a mistake in 2016 when it expanded how and when mifepristone can be dispensed. The pills account for about 2/3 of all abortions in the U.S. and are easily accessible by mail. On one side are anti-abortion rights physicians and organizations. Originally, they argued that the FDA should not have approved mifepristone back in 2000. Now they are focusing on the argument that it should not have made it easier to access in 2016 and 2021.
Yeah, it was a harder argument for them to say that they should kill mifepristone's approval altogether, even though a lower court judge found that. So now they're really focused on access. And so that's that side. On the other side is the FDA and the drug maker, who say that the challengers are not actually harmed by the prescription rules and thus don't have standing to bring the case. Standing always an important factor when it comes to the Supreme Court. Like, do you have the right to be here? Were you hurt by this? And the FDA is arguing that it followed correct procedure and the scientific evidence in making its decision 24 years ago and then subsequently 8 years ago when it expanded access. Again, the anti-abortion right side saying the FDA shouldn't have loosened the restrictions. They followed faulty science here. Notably, if the court rules in their favor, it could shut down telemedicine access to the medication. It could undo retail pharmacies' new ability to dispense it. It could also have implications for how the FDA approves things. There have been a lot of court cases recently in regards to how much power these federal agencies have that isn't specifically written in by Congress. So that's something we're going to follow here. And again, it could have an impact in states where abortion is legal, because again, this is a federal decision when it comes to access to the pill here. And we will watch the proceedings. Jill, a notable thing today at the Supreme Court, all three major lawyers arguing the case are all women, representing the pharmaceutical company, representing the government, and representing the anti-abortion rights side.
And Mosh, that is even more notable, given that women only make up about 12 to 15% of the lawyers who argue in front of the Supreme Court.
Yes, and we should note this term, about a third of all the attorneys who've argued before the court in the cases this term are women. So slowly but surely getting there, especially as you have a bench there of the nine justices 4 of them are women for the first time.
From the Wall Street Journal, Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun will step down at the end of 2024 as part of a broad management shakeup. Larry Kellner, chairman of the board, is also resigning. And Stan Deal, president and CEO of Boeing Commercial Airplanes, is leaving the company effective immediately. The departures come as airlines and regulators have been increasing calls for major changes at the company after a host of quality and manufacturing flaws on Boeing planes. Scrutiny especially intensified after a January 5th accident when a door plug blew out of a nearly new Boeing 737 MAX 9 on an Alaska Airlines flight.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of pushback recently, Jill, from a number of the airline CEOs who are like, we need a change here. We depend on you at Boeing. And in many cases, there was at least one airline CEO who said recently that when they get a new delivery of a new Boeing plane, they spend 2 days checking it out just to make sure no screws are loose, literally, in the plane. And of course, here you had a case of this Alaska plane where bolts were literally missing. That's why it came off mid-flight. As far as Calhoun is concerned, he had actually been preparing to step aside, but this latest crisis has moved up the succession plan. And he came in back in 2019 after those 737 MAX accidents that killed several hundred people. They'd grounded the planes. So he came in 2019 to fix things, to bring more trust to Boeing's process, to clean things up. And unfortunately, he now leaves more than 4 years later, and they're dealing with the same issue here and continued questions about the various MAX jets. There's a 737 MAX 8, MAX 9. They're trying to roll out the 7 and the 10. And a lot of airlines have already put in pre-orders for hundreds and hundreds of these planes. So a lot of questions here also from the U.S. government in regards to Boeing and their relationship with the FAA and whether they're getting the proper amount of scrutiny, given that they're effectively in the U.S. a monopoly. Now, of course, they have Airbus as a competitor abroad, but a lot of questions here, and we'll see who Boeing brings in next to try to clean this up.
And sticking with aviation, this story from Bloomberg, the FAA is considering drastic measures to curb growth at United Airlines, including preventing the carrier from adding new routes following a series of safety incidents, in addition to route restrictions ahead of the all-important summer travel season. United might be barred from flying paying customers on newly delivered aircraft. Now, this is according to people who spoke to Bloomberg and asked not to be identified. The FAA is already suspending United's ability to approve and promote pilots to fly different aircraft models.
Jill, this comes as we've told you about the incidents that several United planes have faced recently for a variety of factors. There was the plane in Oregon last week where they found an external panel missing once they landed on the runway. No one was injured in that incident, but it's just the latest in a series of mishaps here. In just the last month, there was a Boeing plane that spewed flames from an engine after taking off, another one that slid off the runway, one that lost a wheel during takeoff, and another that was leaking hydraulic fluid. So in some cases, mechanical issues, in some cases, Boeing issues, in some cases, pilot error. Either way, this is receiving more scrutiny here. There's really a zero tolerance policy when it comes to aviation and flight safety, as far as the federal government is concerned. And this comes as the government has been pretty hands-off and pretty helpful to these airlines, especially coming out of COVID, as they've expanded. They got a whole bunch of money from the feds to stay afloat during the pandemic there. And so they are seeing a lot more scrutiny now. In particular, we told you in the last story about Boeing, the manufacturer, but in this case, United Airlines.
From TMZ, law enforcement agents raided the homes of Sean Diddy Combs in both Miami and Los Angeles Monday. Homeland Security officials say that the raid was in connection with that federal sex trafficking investigation. According to video footage, there appears to be dozens of armed agents in full tactical gear with rifles walking in and out of the Beverly Hills residence. It is unclear if Diddy was home at the time. It comes as sexual assault allegations against the music mogul continue to make headlines. His ex-girlfriend, Cassie, whose real name is Cassandra Ventura, was the first to accuse Diddy of rape, assault, sex trafficking, and repeated physical abuse in a November 2023 lawsuit. The former couple dated on and off again from 2007 to 2018. Diddy has denied the allegations. He says they are offensive and outrageous, though he did settle her lawsuit out of court for an undisclosed amount of money.
Yeah, as we talk about sex trafficking here, she had accused him of forcing her to have relations with other men in front of him. In the months that have followed her case and the undisclosed settlement that he had with her, at least 4 more alleged victims have come forward accusing Diddy of sexual assault. The most recent claims come from Rodney Jones, known as Little Rod, who accuses Diddy of sexually harassing, drugging, and threatening him while they lived and traveled together between 2022 and 2023. He was a producer for Diddy. Jones is suing Diddy, seeking $30 million in damages. The lawsuit claims, like several of these allegations, that Diddy forced Jones to procure sex workers, pressured him to engage in various acts, and clearly that is a part of the investigation here. There's a lot of evidence they're seeking, including emails and text messages here. According to NBC News, three women and a man have been interviewed by federal officials, and three other interviews are scheduled in relation to the allegations here against the rapper. The warrant comes out of the Southern District of New York, which is currently, it appears, conducting at least one of the criminal investigations.
From The Hill, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill Monday that bans children younger than 14 years from holding social media accounts in Florida. The legislation also requires 14 and 15-year-olds to obtain parental approval to hold accounts on social media platforms that employ algorithms and have certain addictive features, which is all of them. The Florida House Speaker said, "The internet has become a dark alley for our children where predators target them and dangerous social media leads to higher rates of depression, self-harm, and even suicide. Florida leads the way in protecting children online as states across the country fight to address these dangers. The law also bans those under 18 from accessing pornographic or sexually explicit sites by requiring age verification." The signing of Florida's House Bill 3 comes after DeSantis vetoed legislation earlier this month that would have banned children younger than 16 from holding accounts.
Yeah, so this bill overwhelmingly passed in the Florida state legislature, with Democrats joining Republicans here in supporting the measure, though opponents do argue that it's unconstitutional and government should not be interfering in the decision parents make with their children. DeSantis, though, believes that this will hold up in court. He said, "I think this did as good a job as you can do, not just to say here's what we think is constitutional, but also what we think would be ultimately able to land given how some judges have gone on these issues." So it is expected to face legal challenges. Already, we've been hearing from Meta and other social media companies that this is untenable and also they believe unconstitutional. Other states like Arkansas, Ohio, Utah have been trying to regulate social media use. So far, some mixed success, but they're all going through legal issues right now. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 30 states and Puerto Rico have pending legislation this year. Right now, the law is set to go into effect on January 1st. So if, for instance, you have a social media account and you're under the age of 14 in Florida, it will be deleted. It'll be illegal.
Moshe, I will say, as a parent who has already seen even my 5.5-year-old just get absolutely addicted to phones and social media whenever she's around it, I actually applaud this because I think one of the problems, as we've talked about, is that feeling of being left out. It is hard not to get your kid a phone or let them use TikTok or social media when all of their friends are on it. But if it is banned, then nobody is on it. And that feels like a reasonable solution.
Yeah. So while the pushback is let parents do what they want, you're arguing that ultimately making it the law of the land will ensure that your child doesn't come home from school complaining that all their friends have something they don't have access to.
Yeah. So John Haight, who wrote a new book, The Anxious Generation, there's a video of him that I actually posted on my Instagram that's been making the rounds where he says that if you ask kids if they want you to take their social media away, they almost say absolutely not. But if you say, what if we took it away from everybody? They say, yes, please. So I think that says something. All right. And finally, from The Guardian, Barcelona's Sagrada Familia Basilica has a new completion date of 2026, which will come 144 years after the first stone was laid. It will mark the 100th anniversary of the architect Gaudi's death. Okay, what took so long here, 144 years? Well, since its inception, the Sagrada Familia has been dogged by war, neglect, and a lack of finance. Most recently, the COVID pandemic led to a two-year hiatus in work on the site. It will be the tallest church in the world when finished, but more work will still need to be done until 2034. Work will still be done to make sculptures, decorative details, and a stairway leading to what will become the main entrance. When work began in 1882, the site was open farmland, but in the following years, the city has grown up around the church, So Moshe, my takeaway is that work is continuing until 2034. So I feel like the construction's not done until it's done.
It's not over till it's over, even though they said it'll totally be done in 2 years. What's notable is that when Gaudi died, the visionary behind the cathedral back in 1926, only about 15% of the project was done. We now sit here nearly 100 years later, and they're going to finish that sixth of the six towers that you see. But so many details here, Jill, that they're still working on. There's the controversial staircase that I guess will take 8 more years here. And if you dive deep into this, a lot of controversy in regards to his initial vision versus what's being executed here. But it is viewed as one of the wonders of the modern world, at least recently. Initially, some famous folks did not have the best reviews for the Sagrada. Salvador Dali, you may have heard of him, he called it a terrifying and edible beauty. George Orwell considered it to be one of the most hideous buildings in the world and commented that anarchists showed a lack of taste for failing to blow it up when they had the chance. So that was Orwell, Dali. But we sit here today and, you know, we don't build like that anymore. And so, Jill, I haven't been to Barcelona for 20 years. So this will probably give me an excuse to go back. Among the many reasons you go back to Barcelona to see Sagrada completed, kind of, sort of. And then we'll go back for the Mo News podcast in 2034 to see this final staircase, I guess, they're building.
I was there about 7 years ago for the first time, and I thought it was beautiful architecture. And I'm with you. I think it shows that they don't make things like that anymore. Everything just goes up so quickly. I mean, this is now 144 years in the making. Attention to detail.
Yeah. And if you're ever in Chicago, I'll do a pitch for my hometown where we take architecture very seriously. Do a riverboat cruise, do a Chicago River cruise, and they take you past all the buildings and they tell you the various storylines of some of the more beautiful buildings in Chicago and how when they were initially built, everyone's like, oh, this is terrible. This is ugly. And now we sit there, you know, sit here 100 years later. And given where especially commercial architecture is gone, they're like, oh, actually, that's beautiful. We don't build like that anymore.
I don't know. When I go to Europe, I feel like the biggest takeaway is just the United States just doesn't have it when it comes to architecture
and urban planning. All right, let's end here with On This Day in History. On this March 26th, we're going to begin in 1953. On this day, Dr. Jonas Salk announced that he had successfully tested a vaccine against polio. Just the year before that, there were 58,000 new cases of polio in the U.S. 3,000 children had died from the disease. One of the most famous Americans who had experienced polio, of course, was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was stricken at a very young age and was left partially paralyzed throughout his life. And so this was a huge, huge discovery. And he was on the cover of Time magazine at the time as the father of the polio vaccine. All right, fast forward to 1979. On this day, the peace agreement between the Israelis and the Egyptians was signed at the White House. This was a historic agreement between the Egyptians and Israelis after several wars there. Menachem Begin, the prime minister, Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt. Of course, Sadat would be assassinated just a couple years later by Egyptians who were unhappy that he had signed that peace deal. All right, a couple lighter items here on this day in 1973. The Young and the Restless premiered on CBS. Jill, I was recently at Procter & Gamble headquarters in Cincinnati. We'll have more on that next month. But I actually learned a bit of the history behind soap operas coming from the soap companies and how the folks at Procter & Gamble, who made Ivory Soap and other soaps, didn't like the programming in early radio. So they built their own creative division to write shows, like company like Procter & Gamble, and they wrote their own shows for radio with drama and that required you to tune in every day. And what else would they call them but soap operas? Oh,
that's so interesting, Moshe.
Literally, the soap in soap operas comes from the soap companies who are like, Hollywood, you're not writing interesting programming. We don't want to advertise on your boring shows. We're going to write our own shows. So there are a number of famous soap operas that came out of a soap company. And one more piece of history related to a brand many of us know, Pizza Hut, on this date in 1995, announced the stuffed crust pizza. Until that moment, Jill, I don't think people realized they could stick more cheese into the crust. And we have to thank the good folks at Pizza Hut for making that popular then in the mid-90s.
Nothing's ever been the same since.
Jill, will they find new places to put cheese is my question.
Always. There's always room.
Always. There's got to be a place. We end here with a couple of musical items. On this date in 1977. Oh, you're a rich girl, and you're going too far, 'cause you're Rich Girl by Hall & Oates reached number one on the Billboard charts.
Moshe, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast last year when we did this on this day. Lake Street Dive, it's a singing group, does such an amazing cover of Rich Girl. I highly recommend. I like it better than the original.
And one more song, 36 years ago today, Man in the Mirror by Michael Jackson reached number one on the Billboard charts.
All right, let's wrap it there. We want to thank you for listening to the Mo News Podcast. If you like what you hear, share this with your friends. It will help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and review us in the App Store.
Yes, and over on Mo News, The Interview, we have a new conversation out with Elisa Pressman. She's a developmental and parenting expert. Fascinating new book she has out with the science behind a lot of key questions when it comes to raising your kids, and advice and practices for every parent or aunt or uncle or mentor for kids starting with infancy through being teenagers. So definitely check that out over on Mo News, The Interview. I think you will find the conversation really interesting.
More parenting advice. Love it.
Well, what I like about it, Jill, actually, she doesn't tell you what to do. She just says, this is where science is. This is where the facts are. This is where the studies are. Here are the various avenues you can take.
So non-judgmental parenting advice.
Yeah, she's not judging you.
Wonderful.
Yes.
All right, everyone. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News Podcast.